Welcome to Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian, a bi-weekly podcast from the Office of the Undersecretary for Science. This is Volume 4, Number 2, released on January 17, 2006. In this issue, we'll join geneticists as they test evolutionary hypotheses that may shed light on patterns of disease transmission by birds. Peer over the shoulders of planetary scientists as they penetrate the mysteries of the surface of the moon with ground-based radar. Take a trip with animal behaviorists as they observe coatis overcoming the chemical defenses of their intended dinner. And decipher data from a spaceship faithfully circling Mars to see if the surface of the red planet is pockmarked with snow cones. And now, to help us understand how this varied and fascinating scientific effort coalesces into practical knowledge, here's David Evans, the Smithsonian Undersecretary for Science.
West Nile virus and avian flu are on all of our minds these days. This edition of Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian gives us a chance to focus on another example of the Smithsonian's wide-ranging explorations and practical applications of our expertise to real-world problems, in this case, avian flu and West Nile virus. The Smithsonian Biological Science Unit study a vast collection of living and preserved animals. Scientists gather data on both living and extinct wild animal populations in remote and urban settings around the world, and provide public exhibition programs at the National Zoo and the National Museum of Natural History. This vast and seemingly esoteric collection of human and scientific resources, it turns out, has some very practical services to offer the global community at a time when diseases spread around the world first at the plodding pace of a duck's waddle and later at the speed of a jet plane. As the looming menace of avian flu wings its way across Eurasia, the expertise and resources of the Smithsonian scientists are being marshaled to help monitor and mitigate the threat of this and other epizootic diseases, those transmitted between animals and humans. Our national and international network of collaborators, knitted together through decades of Smithsonian-based programs, such as training tropical biologists from developing nations at our Conservation and Research Center, is indispensable when facing these challenges. Thanks to these programs, foreign scientists trained at the Smithsonian can be found heading wildlife reserves and institutions around the world. This creates a cooperative atmosphere and fosters communication that could be achieved in no other way. So we find ourselves uniquely positioned to help track and respond to the identification and spread of avian disease. The Smithsonian currently houses a cadre of specialists in all aspects of bird biology, specialized laboratory and analytical capabilities, and holds existing partnerships with key federal agencies and national and international networks. While we are currently gearing up to assist in the assault on avian flu, it's instructive to look back at our efforts to fight avian malaria and to review our surveillance programs for West Nile virus. We were, for example, the first to track the spread of West Nile virus south into Latin America. The Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center has widely recognized expertise in studying the conservation of birds in managed and fragmented landscapes and the effect of habitat and climate change on bird populations. They focus on the patterns of migration and migration ecology. That knowledge is directly relevant to predicting and tracking the potential spread of avian flu in migratory birds. The Smithsonian has active long-term monitoring programs for birds, including sampling for diseases at its own facilities, as well as collaborating with others. The Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama sits in the migration pathway of some 150 bird species. We also manage the Neighborhood Nest Watch Citizen Science Program and collaborate with other citizen science programs, such as those run by Cornell University. Using the public as observers, these programs provide data on both current status and past occurrence of bird diseases over entire continents. The National Zoo's population of captive birds at Rock Creek and Front Royal are intensively monitored for diseases. They provide a sentinel population for monitoring diseases with links to excellent veterinary, pathology, and diagnostic staff and facilities. The Smithsonian's bird specimen collections at the National Museum of Natural History are another critical resource. When scientists recently reconstructed the 1918 pandemic flu virus and needed to understand the viruses that existed in bird populations at that time, they turned to our museum holdings to extract viruses from preserved tissue samples. It is this combination of cutting-edge scientific knowledge, continually developing expertise, a worldwide network of scientific collaborators, practical on-the-ground and in-the-field experience, and an historic collection of specimens that positions the Smithsonian to play a vital role helping to safeguard both human and animal populations from the continued threat of evolving diseases.
As news of avian flu continues to grab headlines worldwide, Smithsonian geneticists are painstakingly studying evolutionary mechanisms to understand the distribution of this and other infectious diseases that are spread by animals. The success of introduced or invasive species is frequently explained by their escape from natural enemies left behind in their former range. Now, this phenomenon, known as the enemy release hypothesis, is being investigated in connection with the spread of avian flu and other emerging infectious diseases. Learning the distribution of such invasive and potentially disease-bearing species is important to combating their threat. Understanding how they move into new regions is key to the prevention or control of the spread of potentially lethal disease. In an attempt to bring the scientific community a greater understanding of these mechanisms, the head of the Smithsonian Institution Genetics Program, Robert Fleischer, along with postdoc Farah Ishtiak and graduate student John Bedell, recently chose to study parasites in common mina birds. Their study, entitled Prevalence and Evolutionary Relationships of Hematozoan Parasites in Native versus Introduced Populations of Common Mina Acrotheris tristis, is published online in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Their work compares the distribution of malarial parasites using two well-known blood parasite genera, Plasmodium and Hemoproteus. They compared native populations of common minas to six introduced groups. The team's work is the first comparative study conducted on blood parasites in birds that have been introduced in multiple locations from a native region. It therefore provides a vital test for the enemy release hypothesis. The hypothesis basically predicts that a species that relocates leaves behind an enemy, in this case parasites, and is therefore able to do better in the new region without the parasites. Such hypothesis testing is a hallmark of science, a field which prizes constant questioning and probing of theories. The team's conclusions show that not all comparisons of introduced and native populations were consistent with the enemy release hypothesis. Although there is some evidence that common minas may have carried parasite lineages from native to introduced locations, and also that introduced populations may have been infected with novel parasite lineages, it may be difficult to differentiate between parasites that are native and introduced, because malarial parasite lineages often do not show regional or host specificity. For example, populations in Australia and South Africa had equivalent parasite loads to those found in India. In addition, evidence suggests that while minas brought parasites with them from India to their new home in such places as Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand, they also picked up new parasites when they arrived. These findings are particularly relevant, as they might apply to the spread of avian flu and other emerging infectious diseases. Teasing out the relationship between host animals, the diseases they carry, and the environments through which they travel will be an integral part of any attempt to stem the tide of transmission of animal-borne diseases to humans. Now we'll see how the mysteries of the moon are slowly succumbing to the penetrating vision of Smithsonian planetary scientists. Our moon is a quiet place today, with no wind and water to modify the landscape. But billions of years ago, the surface was being changed by outpourings of lava that flooded the basins carved by gigantic impacts. The last of these basins were formed after the great volcanic eruptions began. So in some regions, the record of ancient volcanism is hidden beneath deep layers of impact-generated debris. Older basalt deposits, obscured by later material, are called cryptomaria. A new way to search for ancient volcanic materials is provided by Earth-based radar images that use long radio wavelengths to penetrate deep into the mixed rock and dust layers that cover the moon. A group led by the National Air and Space Museum's Bruce Campbell, and including colleagues at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, has collected a nearly complete radar map of the Earth-facing side of the moon, with a spatial resolution of about 500 meters. The radar signals are transmitted from the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, and echoes from the moon are received at the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. Using a radar wavelength of 70 centimeters, depths up to 50 meters in the lunar highlands can be probed. The new radar data reveal an area of about 180,000 kilometers squared on the west side of the moon that represents ancient basaltic material now covered by debris from the formation of Mare Orientale, perhaps the youngest large basin on the moon. The Cryptomare area has a lower radar echo than the nearby highlands because basalts contain iron and titanium minerals that absorb more of the radio signal. These lava flows may extend even farther west, but the depth of the Orientale ejecta eventually becomes too deep to discern the buried basalt. Ongoing work studies more localized deposits of ancient basalt across the moon and the role of the giant basins in forming the lunar highlands surface. Animal behaviorists are showing how the dining habits of raccoon-like coatis demonstrate that evolution shows no favorites, equipping some prey species with chemical defenses and other predators with the wits to overcome them. Many animals adopt special prey handling methods when they encounter difficult prey. For example, some birds use special methods when preying upon hard-shelled invertebrates, such as snails and some arthropods. Canny birds may smash their prey with rocks or drop them onto hard substrates. Many mammals also prey upon arthropods. Some of these prey items possess irritating hairs or noxious secretions used as a chemical defense. Some mammals have learned the technique of prey rolling. These predators roll the arthropods on the ground to neutralize their smelly defenses. Coatis, Nassau subspecies, which are relatives of raccoons, are well known to prepare noxious invertebrates by prey rolling. This behavior has been observed in the field with a variety of prey items, including millipedes. Coatis have often been observed preying millipedes, and their feces often contains millipede remains. In addition, coatis are well known to depend upon their sense of smell as a means of identifying prey. They typically forage by shuffling their noses through the leaf litter and soil. This behavior prompted a study of the responses coatis show to benzoquinones, which are defense compounds produced by many millipedes. Most millipedes in the tropics secrete these compounds through numerous glands on their body segments. When coatis attack millipedes, they roll them on the ground, thereby neutralizing the negative effects of the benzoquinones. A recent study published by National Zoo scientist Paul Weldon suggests that the chemicals produced by millipedes as a defense mechanism may actually provide predators a way to locate them. Many other insects produce and discharge benzoquinones for defense. This evolutionary defense mechanism may in fact have the opposite effect, attracting predators and providing an ideal means for locating the chemically defended prey. These chemical defenses are then easily defeated through prey rolling behavior. This study represents the first identification of chemicals that may actually elicit predatory behavior in a mammal. Studies like these help demonstrate that evolution is an ongoing and complex intermeshing of biochemical and behavioral relationships between competing species. In this case, a predated animal develops a chemical response to attack, and one class of predator learns not only to foil the defense, but how to use it to its advantage. In our final story, planetary scientists are remotely exploring the subsurface of Mars via their eyes in the sky. The first subsurface sounding data for the shallow crust of Mars has been returned by MARSIS, the Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionospheric Sounding. This scientific package is flying on the Mars Express spacecraft. After the successful deployment of MARSIS in June of 2005, data were collected over the Martian North Polar Cap and Northern Lowlands. The initial data indicate that radar signals penetrated approximately 1.8 kilometers of ice, exposing the base of the North Polar layered deposits. The observations suggest that the North Polar layered deposits are composed of nearly pure to slightly dirty water ice. MARSIS data over the northern lowlands have revealed a series of axially symmetric, parabolic-shaped echoes in two adjacent orbits. The echoes suggest a circular structure that may be a buried impact basin. Such subsurface impact basins have been inferred through observations of subtle topographic depressions visible on the planet's surface. The MARSIS data confirm this inference, while also indicating that there is a population of basins without expression in the topography. In addition to the parabolic echoes, a prominent linear echo suggests an interface up to 2.5 kilometers below the surface. The depth of the interface is consistent with the expected depth of the floor of a 200 to 300 kilometer diameter impact basin. The echo power of the linear reflector suggests a large volume of low-loss material fills the basin. One possibility is that the basin fill is comprised of an ice-rich material. An international team of scientists that includes Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum planetary geologist Thomas R. Waters reported these findings in the journal Science in December 2005. That's all for this issue of Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian. If you haven't already subscribed to the Spotlight podcast, visit spotlight.si.edu to learn how. You can also download archived editions of Spotlight. As always, feel free to share your thoughts with the Spotlight team at spotlight@si.edu.